Before we begin lab lecture today, I wanted to spend a few minutes to go over some of the syllabus. Now, for those of you who are returning students, most of the syllabus is almost identical to the one from last quarter. There are a few changes here and there that I wanted to point out, and then also for the new students, I did want to go over through the most important of the syllabus information. So when you do go to the syllabus, you're going to find out it is quite long, and so I can understand if you don't read through all of it, especially not right away. But the different sections of the syllabus are color-coded, and it's the first few pages that have the purple outlines, that's the core information. So that's what I want to cover first. I just wanted to show, if you hadn't done it yet, the audio and PDF files I am starting to post. So the date itself is to get at the MP3 file, and then you click on the little paragraph symbol to the right of it in order to get the PDF document. The syllabus. There we go. It does have all the contact information. For the few of you that are following my Twitter account, you hopefully saw that I tweeted when the different things got posted yesterday. The Facebook group, I'm also posting to it as well. And then hopefully everybody got the email message I sent out, which for those of you who did check your email since last evening, did you all get the message I sent out? Okay, if you hadn't checked your email, make sure that you got it just so I know that your email in the registration system is correct. I do give a very brief description of the types of things that we're going to be covering this quarter. I'll skim over it for now because you can read it. Just want to remind all of us that this is a class that does have two sections that meet, which you already are quite aware of. So the S75, it's just these two sections that are going to meet for that, and then there's a completely different, separate section 3. One thing that you might want to pay attention to is the information on grades down at the bottom here. So grade format is almost identical to last quarter's. We'll have three quizzes, each of which is worth 33 points. Throw one more point in to round that up, and that's 100 points total. There's three exams, each of which will be 150 points, and then there's the final that's 200 points, and that all adds together to 750 points. For the lab, we have 9 labs scheduled, but we may end up only writing 8 lab reports, so each of those will be worth 10 points. The lab quizzes really will be worth 75 points this quarter. The two of those together will add up to 150 points. Plus, there will be a notebook check at some point in the quarter. That'll be 20 points, and so that brings us up to 250 points total for the lab. Now, one minor change from last quarter is the first sentence of that third block there where it talks about grading. Previously, it had stated that in order to pass the course, you had to complete all of the experiments, which that's still true. Now, if you did end up in a serious accident or had a serious illness or had some legitimate reason why you ended up not being able to complete experiment, then, of course, that means you won't fail the course. This is just because when I first started teaching here, I didn't have a statement like that. People tried to skip the lab but then pass the course because they had enough points otherwise, and that's why I threw that statement in there. In the past, though, I also had a different statement that at some point had gotten dropped out, and that's what I put back in. The statement is that you have to pass the lab, which means that if you do so poorly on your lab quizzes that by the lab itself you would get an F, then that means you won't pass the course. Now, I don't think that applies to anybody that's in here this quarter, but just want to give you a heads up that that is a subtle change. And as long as you don't fail both lab quizzes, you don't even have to worry about it. But you do need to complete all the experiments and pass the lab to pass the course. This course is not graded on a curve. Now, that doesn't mean I might not curve an individual assignment. So I think I already indicated that the third exam and the final from last quarter had a very liberal curve that was applied to it. But when I say I don't grade on a curve, what I mean is I'm not trying to force the grades to be a certain number, A's, B's, C's, D's, F's. So if you all do enough studying, you all, in theory, could get some form of an A. And if you all didn't do a bit of work, well, you all could get an F. And it's up to you which one of those scenarios might come true. I do grade on a pass plus minus scale, so the full grade breakdown is there. And do want to emphasize that you do have to get a C in order to continue on to Chem 12C. Any questions from this front page? All right. A few things I wanted to point out on the second page then. The various registration deadlines. The campus got in trouble some time back for not tightly adhering to these deadlines enough. And so these deadlines I am going to be firm on. You all are already in the course, but if it, for some reason you need to drop, either because you're not interested in the course, you don't need it, your work's conflict with it, you can't stand me, whatever it is, make sure that you pay attention to the appropriate deadline. For those of you who are out-of-state students, the deadline to drop and get your money back is this Friday. For in-state students, the deadline to drop and get your money back is the following Friday. To drop and not have any record showing in your transcript, that deadline is the following Friday, the third Friday. And then there is a pass-fail deadline as well, which I don't know if it applies to anybody in here, and that's kind of the point, because we as instructors don't know who's taking the course as pass-fail. It doesn't show up on our rosters at all. At the end of the quarter when I assign grades, they get put into the system, and then if you're taking a pass-fail, the system converts that to a pass or fail. But if you're planning to do that, then you need to have made up your mind by that deadline, because after which you can't convert the grade back and forth either direction. There is one last deadline, which is the withdrawal deadline. That's March 2nd. That's for a situation where you've made it partway through the quarter, but you've had some serious disruption happen in your life, and you need to drop the course. You're too late to just drop without a record, but it doesn't show up as a grade. Now, I know that when you transfer, there's a concern of how many W's that you have, but my take on it is it's never better to have an F versus a W. So for whatever reason, you can tell there's no way you're going to make it through the course. My advice would be take the W, don't stick it through to get the F. Let's see. Various quiz, exam, and lab exam dates, they are already given to you here, so do go ahead and make sure you mark down on your calendars. There is a disclaimer here that I'm unable to really craft the exam schedule to avoid every other class's exam schedule. So there may be times where you unfortunately have two exams in one day, and unfortunately that's just the life of a college student. So I do not give alternate exams because you've got exams in other courses. Just want to make sure you knew that ahead of time. So the description here of some of the different types of assignments that we'll cover in the quarter. Since we already saw some example problems last time though, for the new people I'll let you just go ahead and read that and I might comment on that another day. Moving on, I want to show you that I do have the topic list here for the quarter. You'll notice that we are going to jump around a bit. And that's because different organic textbook authors have different concepts of how it logically, the different functional groups should be presented. And the one unusual thing that this author does that's not unique necessarily, but it is a rather new approach, is to treat all different forms of carbonyl chemistry as really different forms of the same thing. Now, we're going to be seeing an introduction to aldehydes and ketones today, but there's a whole sequence of compounds that are related to carboxylic acids, and they're referred to as carboxylic acid derivatives. They include things like acyl halides, anhydrides, esters, amides, nitriles even. Much of that chemistry is related to aldehyde and ketone chemistry, which is why they've all been bundled together in the chapters in this text. However, the way that we have our courses structured, carboxylic acid derivative chemistry is not till Chem 12C. And so there'll be some times where we're jumping around in chapters because I'm avoiding Chem 12C topics. There's other reasons why we're jumping around. For example, the very next lab that we do after we finish this first one is about the reaction of a ketone. So I'm going to give an introduction to aldehydes and ketones in terms of nomenclature in lab here today, and then Friday's lecture topic, we're going to see an overview of the carbonyl and how it reacts. There's another major set of topics that there can be a difference in when they're presented, which is benzene. Benzene is a delocalized system, and some instructors at this point of the Chem 12 sequence will present it early, So some instructors would be teaching it almost now, in other words, and others do, as I'm going to do, wait till we've seen some more presentation of functional groups. That's because we also are covering conjugated alkenes this quarter, and to me, benzene chemistry is just a natural extension of those conjugated alkenes. So that's a little explanation why we're jumping around. So don't get freaked out that the things are not in order, because for the most part, those sections we skip are not necessary for the sections we are covering. Now, to help you all out, in addition to this, I've taken the different sections and I've broken it out by the different topics that I'm trying to make sure that we cover for each lecture, and therefore they're the ones, the topics you need to worry the most about when you study. There's a disclaimer here that says it isn't just these topics that's going to be on the quizzes or exams. In fact, for the new people, you never have to ask the question, what's on the test? Because anything that's in class that's said, that's written down, it's part of the notes, that's what's potentially on the test. Now, what you'll learn is when I say something the 16th time, then you start to learn that's a big hint that there's going to be a problem related to that coming up on an exam. Or sometimes I'll flat out tell you, here's something I'm going to ask. So this is to be used as a guide to know what the major topics are that you have to worry about, or it also can be used as a way to help organize your notes. There is also the lab schedule here, and you'll notice that I've put in which parts of the experiment in general that we'll be doing. So if you're the type of person that does like to do their pre-labs early, you know which parts not to spend the time doing. So these are all these different purple bordered pages. We'll cover some of the rest of the syllabus later, but are there any questions before I move on? Now, there is some stuff later in the syllabus in the lab portion, which is the yellow portion of the syllabus, that I wanted to make sure to highlight because I don't think I strongly enough talked about appropriate lab clothing on Monday. So that was partly the reason why I sent that reminder message out last night. There are some restrictions on what you can have as clothing in here. One of the main ones is the type of shoe that you wear. So your shoes can't have any holes in them except for the hole that you use to get your foot in the shoe. For example, I know there's many styles of Crocs that have holes all over them. They're popular. But the whole point of wearing closed-toed shoes is that your feet stick out. And so if you're going to spill, if there's going to be anything that gets on you, it's most likely going to be down below and most likely your feet. And so that's why you can't have any openings in your shoes. Along with that, you have to wear whatever pants, sweats, dresses, whatever that you have, they have to go down to the ankle for the same idea, that things fall down. And you're not as likely to have something blow up and splatter up at you. It's kind of a rarity in this course. But it's not uncommon for people to spill things. And so that's why we worry about what kind of jeans or such that you're wearing. It's recommended that you wear more clothing up top than less, because the more that you're covered, the more that you're not exposed to chemicals. Although we don't have any specific requirements. If you are going to be a science major, I'd recommend a lab coat. I'm going to finally break down and reorder one my own self, because I'm getting tired of being the one chemist, it seems, that doesn't have a lab coat. And it's like, if you're a chemist, you have to have a lab coat. But the other thing you do have to have is goggles, which, yes, we do have the common set of goggles here, but realizing that this is cold and flu season, do you really want to be using communal goggles all the time just to save a few bucks? If the answer is yes, then be free, go ahead and use them, but otherwise, you might want to go invest in your own set of goggles at some point. For new students, if you are a science major and you haven't been told this, there are such things as prescription safety goggles. And so if you wanted to invest in those, that might be a good long-term investment. One thing I forgot to tell Section 1 is that if you wear contacts, you need to be careful. Now, I don't wear contacts myself, and maybe the technology behind contacts has changed, but there was a time when I was a student where we were told that certain bases could actually have a very negative reaction with a contact, which ends up basically sealing the contact to your eye. Not a very pleasant thing, I would imagine. So now, with the types of chemicals that we're using in here, probably not an issue. But just wanted to put it out there that you want to think a little bit, especially when you go change your contacts. I hope everybody's in the habit of washing your hands after you leave the lab. No matter why, just wash your hands off so you're not contaminating yourself. Now, there's a couple other safety things that I was looking over this morning that made me think, yes, for a reminder for everybody else, but for the new people as well, you should be aware of a few of my pet peeves. And section one already demonstrated that even though I'm about to tell you the way that things need to work, I got promptly ignored even today. So let's see if you all can be a little bit more diligent. And what I'm talking about specifically is this balance area. What always happens in every chemistry course when there's balances out is they may start out clean like this at the beginning of the lab period, and within 20 minutes of an experiment starting, it looks like someone took a bag of chemicals and just sprinkled it all over the place. Which I really don't get, because you all maybe don't realize the types of chemicals you're going to be using this quarter. The example I gave this morning was aluminum trichloride, ALCl3. You use the solution of it back in Chem 1A, and solutions of it aren't so harmful. But aluminum trichloride itself is an extremely strong electrophile. And in fact, when it's left, it's just a sort of a whitish, yellowish, powdery solid. And when it's left out in the open, it decomposes into hydrochloric acid. I'll back up and say that again. It's reactive enough that when it decomposes, it makes hydrochloric acid, which we all know is a corrosive chemical. If you took a bottle of aluminum trichloride, open up the cap, and just waved a piece of pH paper over it, it turns pink because there's that much hydrochloric acid just being let off. So when you use aluminum trichloride later this quarter, and if you come over the balances and just letting it sit around, that means every time you walk past or handle anything near it, you're basically getting bombarded by hydrochloric acid. So that's why, aside from just trying to be good lab students, it's so important that you don't make a mess of the balance area like that, because you don't know, unless you've looked it up, what the chemical hazards are. Now, I know the situation that happens. There's 26 of you, and at the moment, there's just this handful of balances here. And so you're worried about the people behind you getting annoyed that you're taking so long to carefully measure things out. And so when you spill just a few grains of the solid on here, you think, oh, that's okay, it won't be noticed, or someone else is going to make a mess, they'll clean it up anyways later on. Except that's what every single person ends up doing, because once the first person comes, makes the mess, the second person says, that's not my mess, why should I clean it? And then we end up with exactly what happened earlier today, where I came over as the lab was in progress, and there was crap all over the balances, even though I had just made this big speech about not doing that. And which annoys me, because this isn't your lab, this is our lab. Actually, this is not even mine, I'm just an employee, I'll be gone one day too. But in other words, this is not any of our individual space. So we don't have the right to make a mess and cause a safety hazard for the other people in the room. So the threat that I guess I will carry through on this quarter is that at any point of the lab, not just the end when I know you all are scrambling to clean up to make me happy, at any point of the lab, if I walk over here and it's a mess, then everybody just gets a zero for that experiment. And you might say, that's kind of harsh. And yeah, it is, because that's how serious cleanliness is. And even if I was walking around continuously while the lab was in progress, as soon as I walk to that side of the room, I'm not going to see what happens on this side necessarily. So I can't catch who's making the mess. But you are all equally responsible, which is why you'll all just get a zero. And I will have to do it this quarter if you are going to make messes like the first section did on the first day. Please clean up after yourselves. It really isn't so tough to do, and I don't understand how the few of you that do make a mess expect that you're going to be employed very long once you do get out of college, especially in this kind of economy where you don't need much of a reason to get rid of anybody anymore. Now, along with that, and this again confuses me every quarter why I need to explain something like this, there are so many of you that think that properly closing a reagent bottle is just taking a cap and doing this. But if this were a bottle of a thiol, and I left it sitting with a cap like this, after a few minutes we'd have to evacuate the building because of how bad it would smell. Thiols are just incredibly nasty smelling compounds. It's in a portion of like one part per because natural gas doesn't smell a chemical they put in place. But the idea being, how can you consider this acceptable to just leave a tap on here? Again, meaning you're going to expose yourself or other people to chemicals. So I'm going to be checking your reagent bottles to make sure that you carry through with that. Another related thing, but not necessarily something I'll take points off for, but I want to point out there's some legal issues involved. It's this cart of acids and bases that we have over here. So there's many acids and bases that you'll find in almost every experiment that we do in a quarter. And so instead of the stocker taking the time to put them in and pull them out of the chemical kits every single time, we leave them here for you all to use. Now, notice that these acids are in containers. This is what's known as secondary containers. And the idea is that if you have something really reactive like an acid, there may be some random event that causes that bottle to break. Well, if that happens, you don't want the acid to pour all over the lab bench where other chemicals are stored, so you put it in another container so that the container keeps it from flowing everywhere. That means, though, that everything inside that secondary container needs to be compatible. And so when you come over here, you'll notice all the different types of acids are in their own secondary containers. There is a shelf of bases. Hopefully it would be obvious that you have to keep acids and bases completely separate from each other. And here's the thing that worries me, though, is that because you all, again, are in a rush, I noticed last quarter, repetitively, people would take something from the base shelf, and because it takes all that effort, I mean, some of you are almost half my age, but some of you can't seem to take the effort to put it back down on the lower shelf. You put the base right next to some of these acids. If an inspector came in right at that moment, there'd be all kinds of trouble. Aside from that, you don't want an unintended acid-base reaction. So if you're using this shelf over here, one, we already discussed and we decided it is okay to move this over a little bit closer to the exit door while the lab is in progress, only because the people in the fume hood here were getting knocked out by the fumes of the acetic acid being used. So if you want to pull that cart out and don't block the exit, but move it towards that direction, then we can move it back later on. But please just be aware, don't just set the bottle down somewhere because you're done with it. Take a little personal responsibility and put it back into the correct secondary containment. Now, just a couple of last things. There is waste bottles that I have set up in the front of the classroom. I have them up here this time because the fume hood is occupied with a new piece of equipment that we have, which, if you allow me, ignore the fact that I don't have goggles on just for a moment. Did I show you all this in the movie? No, we didn't have this out. Okay. This is our new acetone bath, because we got tired of trying to explain to no good the fact that if you have a 100 milliliter beaker, it makes no sense to put 90 milliliters of acetone in it to clean it out. Because when you put that much one that's labeled as aqueous. The last thing from the syllabus, in fact, I'm not sure if I have this in the syllabus, might need to go add this, is that if you're storing chemicals, you do have to label them. And that's because if there was a fire or something like that, emergency response crews, when they come in, they need to be able to quickly identify what the hazards in the room might be. So solids do not need to be capped. They don't have to be contained in that sense. Liquids do. And in fact, anticipating the end of lab today, you'll want to store your reaction mixture in most likely the reaction flask that you use, which instead of a round bottom flask, we're using pear-shaped flasks. Either the blue stoppers that you have or the glass stoppers would be appropriate for stoppering up that pear-shaped flask. If you use the glass stoppers, there's a tube of grease over there. We put just a little bit of tiny grease around it because ground glass connections, when you put them together, have the potential for freezing, meaning they get stuck. And so that grease helps to prevent that. Because we are using ether as one of the extraction layers, if you get that far in the experiment today, grease can kind of be eaten away by the ether, and so that's why I might recommend that you use the blue stoppers today to stopper up your products once you're done. Make sure that you do label it, and when you label it, you have to put your name, the date when that sample was created, and then you need to list the major components of it in English, meaning no formulas, no shorthands, no structures. You have to write out the name. My suggestion for the solution you're going to end up with would be to put down that it has acetone, acetic acid, bleach, and by that time your product, the cyclododecanone. So anytime that you're storing something, please remember, label it. And again, liquids need to be sealed off, but solids, not necessarily so. Now, any questions before I now begin the lab lecture proper? All right. Do review the safety rules that I have in the syllabus. There may be a sign-out form, in fact, that I hand out at some point to ensure that we've all read those. But let's go ahead and, oh, question, yes. Well, I have one idea, and we'll have to see if it works. I don't know if it dissolves in acetone or not, but I've got a wax pencil. So that, we can back up at once, so you can try labeling and dunking in there and see if this wears off or not. If it doesn't wear off, we've got our solution. Other questions? All right, so let's switch over to lab notes. I'm going to skip over the mechanism for this reaction and some of the details of the reaction because when I did this morning, I realized I was making you run out of time. And there is one topic even before the lab I want to cover because we're synthesizing a ketone in this experiment. And the very next experiment we're doing is to react a ketone. So because we have some time, I want to do an introduction to the nomenclature of aldehydes and ketones. So first, let's start with identifying the two different functional groups. So an aldehyde is this kind of, is this kind of compound, where you have a carbonyl, which hopefully everybody is familiar with the fact that a CO double bond is known as a carbonyl bond. So one side or the other must have a hydrogen directly connected. That's what makes the compound an aldehyde. And it is possible to have two hydrogens. That would make it the compound formaldehyde, that's a common name, or methanol, and we'll see how to do proper names in just a moment. Related to this is a ketone. A ketone, however, cannot have a hydrogen directly connected to the carbonyl. Let's start with the nomenclature of aldehydes first. Since an aldehyde is a compound that must have a hydrogen connected to the carbonyl, they're by default always terminal. And because of that, you don't need position numbers. You don't need locants to name aldehydes. We use these position numbers to be able to tell isomers apart. But there's no such thing as an aldehyde at the 2 position, for example. So the functional group ending for an aldehyde is al, A-L. And you tack it on after the N in a compound name. So for example, this 4-carbon compound, that's butane, drop the E, it turns into butanal. Even if we had 2 aldehydes, again, they would have to be both at the end positions of a molecule. So we could call this simply butane dial. Now, that really pesky minor spelling rule, notice that in butanal there's no E, because we don't in the system put 2 vowels together like this normally. Notice that the E comes back when we put the di in there, because now we would otherwise have 2 consonants bumping into each other. Now this is if we just have a plain aldehyde. What if we had some other functional group on there? Well, let's remind ourselves of functional group priority. Functional group priority is not directly related to reactivity, although there are some cases where the 2 overlap. For example, for reasons we'll cover Friday, aldehydes are more reactive than ketones. And partly because of that, aldehydes are considered more important in terms of nomenclature, because there can be only one main functional group ending in a molecule. In fact, make me make that a statement. A compound may only have one primary functional group ending. And so that's why you'd use this set of priorities to figure out how to name a molecule. So aldehydes more important than ketones, both of which are more important than alcohols. So part of this rationalization is that the lower priority functional groups are saturated functional groups, only having single bonds. Most of the unsaturated functional groups are given higher priority. Below alcohols, then, we have plain old hydrocarbons. So alkenes and alkynes would be below an alcohol in priority. So let's say that we had a compound that had both an alkene and an aldehyde. Well, in this case, in theory, I could number the chain from either direction and have a functional group end up with the number 1. But going right back up to this functional group priority list I just had, an aldehyde is more important than an alkene. And so that's going to establish the numbering direction starting from the right, so that we give the more important functional group the lower number. Now back up to the simple aldehydes. Notice that the N remains in that name. I remember last quarter for nomenclature problems, there was a lot of trouble with what to do with this AN part here. Almost every single compound name has that in there, to show that you have a saturated compound. The only time it changes normally would be something like this, where now we do have an alkene. Alkenes and alkynes are kind of the exception to where you only put one functional group ending in. And that's just the way the naming system was designed, because it's so common to have double and triple carbon-carbon bonds. So this is a four-carbon compound. So we start out with bute. But it's an alkene. So instead of saying ane, A-N, we're going to say ene, E-N. It's at the 3 position, so this is bute 3-E. It's an aldehyde, but because it's an aldehyde, we don't need a number, but we do need to say that it does have that functional group. So this would be bute 3-ene-al. What if we had an alcohol instead of an alkene? So same four-carbon compound. But now I'll put an alcohol on it. R or S?
3.
Good. R, because the alcohol, oxygen is more important. A carbon with anything other than hydrogen is more important. And then a carbon with only hydrogen on it is the less important, other than the hydrogen that's correctly in the back. So yes, this is an R stereocenter. Alcohol is less important than the aldehyde, so we can't call this an all. Well, what do? Well, we turn this into a substituent. So an alcohol substituent is called hydroxy. Now, there is a term hydroxyl, which refers to a radical. In standard nomenclature like this, the L, we don't use it. It's just hydroxy. So the hydroxy group is going to be at the 3 position. Again, because the aldehyde establishes. Sorry. Aldehyde establishes the numbering direction. So 3-hydroxy, then it's still just plain butane now. Questions on nomenclature so far? Yes?
So if we have an alkyne in the first example, so we will say
butyl-3-al. Exactly. Now, one question I'm still not going to answer quite yet is, what if we have alkenes and alkynes together? System's a little tricky how to do it, so that's why I've avoided these types of problems so far. But I would like to show you an example of where we have an aldehyde, an alkene, and an alcohol all on the same molecule, because it's not an entirely rare kind of critter to have. Ponder that molecule for a moment, and I'll go over the naming. Now, while you're working on this, let me comment a little bit on the double bond there. Is it possible to have an isomer of this molecule where the double bond is still in exact same position? Let me ask the question another way. Would the term cis or trans be used to describe this molecule? Or a better, more focused question, can I use the term cis or trans to describe just the double bond?
Oh dear.
The answer is yes. That's trans, isn't it? Which maybe you can't see it. It seemed like there was some difficulty this morning visualizing it. If I draw the extra hydrogens in here, it might help show that those two hydrogens are trans to each other. Yes, it's appropriate to use cis and trans here because I only have one substituent on either side of the double bond. In other words, each carbon only has one group on it. And so it would be okay to use cis-trans. I could use E and Z also. And so what I originally was trying to get at is, yes, we need to use one of these terms because it's not a terminal alkene. That there is the possibility of having another isomer of this. Now, I can describe the bond as cis-trans. Can I name the whole molecule using the terms cis or trans? Which is, that is a different question from whether the bond is cis or trans. Well, the rule is, if you only have one double bond that needs to be specified, yes, you can use cis-trans. The whole problem with cis-trans is you can only make one and only one comparison. So if this is the only comparison being made, which it is, we could use cis-trans. But we have a stereocenter too, don't we? And so we're going to have to use R and S already. So to make a cleaner name, I'd prefer use the E and Z, because you can lump those into the same set of parentheses that you use R and S with. And I prefer E and Z in general anyways. So, is this E or Z? And that's not a yes-no question. The new people, I might ask questions sometimes like, is this E or Z? And the answer is not E or Z, the answer is no. Because if you have a terminal alkene, it's neither E or Z. So when I ask, is it E or Z, the correct answer is no. But in this case, it is one of the two. So is it E or is it Z? E. E is the same as trans. And if you have difficulty remembering that, remember that cis is similar to Z, right? Now, what about the stereocenter, R or S? It is S, but in order to make sure you get the right answer, you have to use phantom atoms. Do we all remember what phantom atoms are? They're the fact that if you have a double bond, you have to replicate the atoms in that double bond so that there's a systematic way to assign priority to unsaturated systems. In other words, we would rewrite the molecule in this way. So here's everything on the molecule other than the double bond that's supposed to be there. And again, when we have these unsaturated systems, we double whatever the bond is connected to. So one carbon is doubly bound to another carbon, and so we put a second carbon in to show that. It's a carbon-carbon double bond, so both of the carbons end up with this extra phantom carbon. Now, how does that apply to determining the stereocenter in this case? Well, if we look at the stereocenter itself, it's got an oxygen, a carbon, and a carbon attached. So we can't, from just the immediate atoms attached, determine what the priority is. So we have to see instead what's attached to that carbon, what's attached to that carbon. So on the right hand of the two carbons, what is attached? Well, there's the carbon that the carbonyl is part of, and then otherwise there's two hydrogens at that point. On the left of the carbons, because we have now formally used that phantom atom, we can see that there's technically two carbons attached at that position. The way that this priority determination works is the first point of difference rule, which means you try to make your decision at that first atom that's attached. And only then, if you can't figure out, then you go to the next position out. Only if you can't figure from that next position out do you just keep on going. Well, at that first position now, we do see we have CCH versus CHH. The C in the middle here is more important than the H, and so that makes that right hand, or the, sorry, the left-hand side the more important of the two carbon groups. So now we have priority one on the oxygen, priority two on this left-hand group, priority three on the right-hand group, and there is the unwritten hydrogen that is correctly in the back of the molecule for visualization. So one, two, three, going around counterclockwise, that means yes, this really was an S stereocenter. So good for all of you who did say S. So now let's fold all this together into a name. It doesn't matter whether it's R or S or E or Z. You list all these different stereo descriptors in numerical order. So we're going to number the compound from the right again. And so this will be 3S4E, 3-hydroxy, hex-4-ene-al. That'll be about as complicated of a molecule as we get. Now let me briefly show you a little bit of nomenclature of ketones, although we do need to kind of get moving on here to run a little low on time. So, ketones, you do have to name the carbonyl position, because by default, a ketone must be an internal functional group because you can't have a hydrogen on the carbonyl. We would number this in such a way to give that as low a number as possible. So from the left, if we numbered it, it would get number 4. If from the right, if we numbered it, we'd get number 2. And so we would number this from the right. It's a 5-carbon compound, so it's pent. It's otherwise unsaturated, so the ane is there, and then we show 2-ohm to show the position of the carbonyl. Now, I do have to mention that just like we saw a common system of nomenclature for ethers this afternoon, we're going to see a common nomenclature for ketones, just not today because we're running out of time. One step more complicated than this is what if we have multiple ketones on the same molecule? So in this case, numbering from the left, the first carbonyl we would run into would have position 2. Then we numbered it from the right. The first carbonyl we ran into would be position 3. So we're going to number it from the left. It is a 7-carbon compound, so it's hept. It is unsaturated, so it's ane. We're going to have to use one of these multiplying prefixes because there's 3 carbonyls, so there's going to be a tri. We don't put an N and a T next to each other, so we're going to put the E there. We need to name the positions of the carbonyls. They're the positions 2, 4, and 5. So this is heptane 2, 4, 5, trione. Got 3 more quick examples to do, and that'll be it for nomenclature today. Let's throw an alkene in there. Now this, we again use functional group priority, because if I was ignoring functional groups, it might look at this and say, oh, well, the alkene, you could number it from number 1, and the ketone would only receive number 2, but that doesn't matter. The ketone's more important, so that forces the numbering from the left, which, yes, gives a bigger number to the alkene, but it's the less important functional group. So this is pent because it's 5 carbons, 4 ene because it's unsaturated, 2 one, naming the position of that ketone. What about an alcohol instead? Well, just as before, when an alcohol becomes the less important functional group, it becomes a hydroxy substituent. So this would be 4-hydroxybutane-2-one. What if you had both an aldehyde and a ketone? Well, the aldehyde is the most important functional group. And so we're going to have to name this as al. But what do we do about a ketone? How do we make it a substituent? It has the substituent name oxo. So this becomes 3-oxobutanal. Questions? All right, so let me give you just a brief introduction to what it is that you're doing today. It is an oxidation reaction, which again, even though the mechanism's simple, I'm going to skip it for today. I'll just show you, that notation-wise, sometimes chemists will just use an O in brackets to represent oxidation without getting into worrying about which reagents are being used, just focusing on the type of reaction going on. So we are oxidizing cyclododecanol into cyclododecanone using bleach oxidation, which is a safer set of conditions than some other possible oxidations. To demonstrate this as an oxidation, let's discuss the oxidation state of carbon, the reactive carbon, in both of these molecules. Now, I discovered this morning that we're going to need to go back and have a bit of review from Chem 12A, which was a review from Chem 1A, which is the difference between oxidation state and formal charge. Because I asked this morning, what is the oxidation state of carbon at the alcohol position? And I'll ask that to this group. What is that oxidation state? 0. Who said that? How'd you get that? Okay, and so are you doing that on the rules of what oxygen and hydrogen usually would be for oxidation states? Or were you doing that based off electronegativity? So there is this overall rule which says the sum of all the oxidation states in a molecule has to add up to 0. And so you could use the normal rules to figure out what oxygen and hydrogen should be. But I have a kind of a problem with those rules, because if I wanted to quote the way that they're expressed in 1A, oxygen is -2 except when it's -1 except when it's 0. Hydrogen is +1 except when it's not. Chlorine is -1 except when it's not. Every single element you name, even fluorine. Fluorine's -1 except if it's F2 and then it's 0. Why have a system of rules where it could be anything? What's the rule for carbon, by the way? You are right. The answer you're giving is entirely correct. Really, though, that means that carbon can be anything from +4 to -4, depending on what's connected to it. And that's what he's saying as far as hydrogen you count as this and chlorines and such you count as that. Because what you really do is the following. You look at what's directly connected at that position. And we use the definition of what oxidation state is. Oxidation state is treating all bonds as if they're ionic bonds. electrons, meaning that the electrons are given to whichever atom is more electronegative in that bond. Formal charge, you treat everything as completely covalent bonds, which means we would break all the bonds homolytically to give one electron to each atom in that bond. So if we did that to this molecule, broke it apart, well, the oxygen is more electronegative than carbon, so it would get the pair of electrons that would be in that bond. One carbon versus another, they're equal electronegativity. So the central carbon would get one electron from each of those. And then the hydrogen down below, it's less electronegative than carbon, so both the electrons would come back to that carbon if we were counting electrons this way. The real truth is there is no such thing as oxidation state. There is no such thing as a formal charge. There's dipoles. And these are some ways to try to quantify these dipoles, but again, from two different perspectives. One an ionic perspective, one a covalent perspective. Once we've done this breaking of the bonds in this way, though, how many electrons do end up on that central carbon? Four, right? And then how many electrons would unreacted elemental carbon have in its valence shell? Also four. Since those numbers match, that's why this does have an oxidation state of zero. Now, what if we did the same analysis on the other molecule? And again, I'm focusing just on that carbon that's connected to the functional group. Breaking it apart, it would look like this. Oxygen would get both sets of electrons from carbon. There's now a double bond, but oxygen is still more electronegative. Again, if we have carbon versus carbon, then each carbon would retain one electron from the bond in this counting system. None of these bond breakings really happen. This is just the way they evaluate the molecule. How many electrons end up on that central carbon then? How many, again, does it want to have as a unreacted element? Four. So it's got two instead of four, which means it has an oxidation state of plus two, which means it was oxidized. It is an oxidation reaction. Now, we'll review these rules again in a little bit more depth next lab period, which... we don't have class on Monday because it's a holiday, so the next lab day will be Wednesday instead. But since we are so low on time now, really we should have had our break by now already. Let me just run through a brief overview of what you're doing for your reactions today. And actually this morning what I did, just to throw everybody off, is I started with the first person, had the first person explain the first direction from the pre-lab you all have, and then I went to the next person, and the next person, and the next person, and the next person, and the next person. You now are aware this will happen, and so hopefully that will make sure that you have your pre-labs ready for the next experiment, which your next pre-lab is due 2 weeks from 2 days ago. So Monday of the third week of class. Now, I didn't make any written comments. I would question for a couple of you in here whether you really could complete the experiment without looking at your lab text, since some of you had pre-labs that were only that long. It doesn't mean the people that had 20-page pre-labs were automatically correct. It could just be that you have the directions in your head well enough, but when you prepare your next pre-lab, just think. If there's all these different washes and layers and things running around, do you have that all well enough specified in your pre-lab so you could do the lab without looking at your text? But because we're so low on time, and I think I took even longer in this section, I'll tell you what's going on. The first part of the reaction is just a shake and bake reaction where you're throwing most of the reagents together, heating them up, and then slowly adding the bleach to it. The very first thing you want to do when I stop talking then is get your sand bath out and get it heated up, because you know how long it takes to get sand baths warm. It says to get a reaction temperature of 45 degrees, but that likely could mean that you want a sand bath temperature of 100 degrees, which means you want to set the sand bath, the hot plate, maybe at 150, 200 degrees at first. You do want to monitor the temperature, but don't put the thermometer directly into the reaction flask. These are supposed to be pretty impervious thermometers, but I get a little worried whenever we're using concentrated acids like the glacial acetic acid that you're using. If you're not familiar with what glacial acetic acid is, that's really concentrated, which means two things. One, it's corrosive, and two, it'll knock you out from the smell if you're not careful. So just when you're opening the bottle, be a little bit careful that you're not going at the same time, because it will smell like the most intense salad that you ever had in your life. Now, you mix all the reagents together. Again, you're going to be having about 45 degrees. Again, monitor the temperature in the sand bath. So the sand bath itself should be significantly hotter than the flask. You're supposed to be heating at reflux, which if you don't remember what that means you're going to be heating it to about the boiling point of the solution. And then that solution's going to evaporate. You're going to have a condenser on top, which then the vapor turns back into a liquid, drops back into the reaction flask, and then that's a continuous process. So you've got your own little miniature chemical waterfall going on. Now, in your lab text, it shows a picture of a water condenser, but to simplify everything, let's just use an air condenser, because it looked like the morning section got away without having to switch to the water condenser. How would you know you would need to make that switch? Well, if as that stuff is boiling, the solvent front crawls further and further up the tube. Well, that means the air is not doing enough to cool it down, and that's why that level keeps rising. If it looks like it's going to rise out, that means you're going to boil everything off, which you don't want. But nobody told me that that happened this morning, so I'm presuming we don't have to worry about it. So use an air condenser instead of the water condenser. You're going to leave it spin for half an hour once you've got it at the right temperature. Then you're supposed to check it periodically using starch paper. The logic behind that is the following. You're using bleach to oxidize the alcohol. If you use up all the bleach, how can you be sure that you converted all the alcohol? So what you do is you let it react for a while. You test it on the starch paper. If you don't see anything happen, that means there's no bleach. Then you have to worry, ooh, was there enough bleach for the reaction to happen? And we err on the side of caution and add more bleach in. And you do that until after it's reacted, when you test it on your starch paper, you get a positive reaction. Positive reaction means you have excess bleach, which means you had enough at least to do the reaction. Now, don't dip the starch paper into your reaction flask, because the chemicals of the starch paper will just get into your reaction. Instead, you're going to touch a pipette or a stir rod or something to the solution and then touch that to the starch paper. You then have a series of washes, and this part I'll write down part of. Because in fact, the way you start out after you finish the reaction is you're supposed to have two different layers, aren't you? Which one's going to be on top, the aqueous or the organic layer? Organic? Does it tell you that? Then how do you know that? Why are you likely correct? Because generally organic solutions are less dense than water. The notable exception is halogenated solvents like chloroform and methylene chloride. How could we check to make sure the top layer really is the organic layer? Add in a drop of water. Why? What would happen? That's right. If it tunnels through the top layer and combines and makes the larger or the bottom layer larger, that means the bottom layer was the water layer. If it stops right at the top layer and gets absorbed in and makes that layer larger, that means the top layer was the aqueous layer. I'm assuming, because no one commented, that this is the normal case where the bottom's going to be aqueous, the top's going to be organic. So the very first thing that you do then is you take that organic layer and isolate it. So you drain off first the water layer. Separately, you drain off the organic. You then take the water layer and put it right back into the separatory funnel, don't you? What do you add to it then? Diethyl ether. You're doing an extraction to try to get as much of the organic product out of that water layer as possible. You'll get two layers again. And now you get rid of the aqueous layer. Because now that you've gotten all the product you can out of it, you don't need the aqueous layer. You're then left with the organic layer. And not to make this too confusing, but now you add the original organic layer into it. So now here's what a wash is. You start with the organic. You add the wash. You end up with two layers. You shake it up. Get rid of that aqueous layer, because all you care about is the organic layer. And that whole process is a wash. Let me step out just temporarily to get a separatory funnel. I want to remind us some stuff about separatory funnels. So, on these separatory funnels, they're going to come, well, they should come with, little pieces of paper stuffed in where the stopper is, and that's because the stopper, again, is ground glass and might lock in if it's just stored plain. So make sure that when you return this back to the stockroom, you have a little piece of paper in there, or otherwise they'll yell at you and tell you to go back and do it anyways. When you're using the separatory funnel, remember that the nozzle here, if the valve is turned so it's parallel with the flow, that means it's open. If it's perpendicular, that means it's closed. Make sure you close it before you fill it so it doesn't just go pouring right out on you. When you want to use the separatory funnel, you're going to hold the stopper and the funnel together, turn it upside down. Don't point it at you or someone. Shake it, making sure that occasionally you stop shaking and you vent the pressure, particularly when you get to using volatile solvents like ether. Then turn it back, shake it again, vent. Turn it, shake it one last time, re-invert it, let the two layers settle, and then continue using. What are the washes that you're doing? Well, first, sodium bicarbonate, which is used to neutralize excess acid. You're then following it with sodium bisulfite, which reduces excess bleach. And finally, you're following it up with a sodium chloride wash, which forces out ionic impurities. The rest of what you need to do, I'll talk about next time, because we're really, really out of time. What you need to accomplish today is measure everything out. Before you even start measuring, get those sand baths heating up. Assemble your reaction. Hopefully you'll have a good half an hour of it being heated up. If you don't get a full half hour in, just store it as is, continue heating next time. I'll make sure that the lab lecture next time is significantly shorter so you have more time to work. If you get done quickly enough that you have time to do some of the washes, that's fine. Otherwise, at whatever stage your reaction ends up in, store it as is, but again, make sure that you label anything that you're going to store. I'll leave this last sheet of the notes sitting up here if you wanted to come look at the diagram again. Otherwise, any last questions before we get going? Yes?
What is the filter tube
pipette? The filter tube pipette?
Tip pipette?
A filter tip, that's one of those pasture filter pipettes like what we made last quarter for doing the filtrations of our solutions. Okay, let's get to work.